So I'm continuing a series of talks that I've been offering really since the beginning of the year, and the path that the Buddha laid out, which is oftentimes referred to as the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's a path of practice, not so much a path of not so much a path of belief, more so a path of, you know, what can I do? What tools can I use? What inner resources can I build and develop to alleviate stress and suffering in my life and the lives of others? At its base, what I talked about last week is this ethical foundation of non-harming, compassion, non-cruelty, non-violence. Makes the meditation practice a lot easier when our actions are skillful. I just want to say, I guess, before I really dive in, is that I'm sitting here with a little bit of a heavy heart. Someone near and dear to me lost someone close to them today, and so I'm just holding him, my friend, in my heart. In a lot of ways, the Dharma, mindfulness, is a relational practice. The Buddha encouraged the practice of mindfulness to be one that's an inner exploration, looking internally and looking externally into our greater world, into our communities, into our political arenas, our arena of economics and the arena of culture, and then encouraged a relationship between the internal and the external, between these two worlds. And there's a creativity, I think, to the Dharma. There's a creativity to mindfulness. There's a creative engagement. There's a skillful and a curious interest in how we live our lives and how we engage in the world. And so I'm talking in particular about one aspect of relationship tonight, which is communication. It's the third factor of the Eightfold Path, wise communication. There's really a wide array of ways that we communicate. We have this inner communication. We have our, and I think psychotherapy, they may call this the core beliefs. We have self-talk. We have our perceptions of the world, largely conditioned from our memories of past experiences. And this greatly affects how we live in the world, is our perceptions and our thoughts. So we communicate internally with the parts of ourselves. Right? Maybe you notice this even when you sit in meditation, as you can kind of watch the mind talk to itself quite a bit. A lot of times my experience has been is it's like my mind, I have spent a lot of time talking myself down from a lot of ledges internally. So there's kind of that internal communication, and there's also, of course, this interpersonal level. Communication with others, but that exists in a lot of ways as well. We have nonverbal communication through our gestures, facial expressions, even our appearance. What we choose to wear, in a way, is an expression of communication. Our postures, the distance we place between ourselves and others, how we hold the body. We have normative communication, shaking hands. Maybe here you may bow. We have a lot of signs and a lot of ways to engage and interact with our world. We also communicate through our actions, and just our direct actions, what we do for ourselves and what we do for others. So in a way, really nothing really exists outside of communication. And of course, we have our verbal and our written communication. We have social media, we have slang, we have lingo, we have advertisement, we have speech, writing, email, text. So it's a huge topic, and I think that I've experienced more harm in the area of communication probably than any other area. If I kind of was to tally it up, things that have been said to me or written to me, those are really the things that I think have caused and been the cause of the most harm. And also, most of the joy that I've experienced has been through laughter and good friendship and ways that I've communicated. And the Buddha spoke often to the complexities and the need for great care in how we communicate. So there's not so much in any of the Buddhist tradition any set of rules, but more so just bringing this area of our lives that takes up a lot of our life into our awareness and being interested in how we generate well-being or how we generate suffering, how we communicate. He emphasized the importance of friendship, who we associate with, and community. We're social beings. We're very, very influenced by those who we hang around. Probably the most social animal, I would say, on the planet. And so who we spend our time around, we're really going to mirror those systems of interacting. So even just kind of being aware of our social dynamic, which he encouraged. He included it in two of the eight path factors, which makes us think that probably he valued this training of wise communication pretty highly. He included this in its own path factor of wise speech, but also, again, it appears in wise action, which is the next path factor. He also spoke a lot in his teachings. What he would do is he would speak in the language of the people he was talking to. So, and this is really where I want to start in talking about communication. The Buddha would really spend most of the time listening and understanding the language and understanding the ways that people interact and understanding, probably through our own reflection of our own thoughts and our own emotions, trying to understand and to listen to the thoughts and the emotions, seeing through the words or the content into, the humanness of interacting. I really think that, one of the most important parts of communication is active listening. It's something, it's easily the area of communication that I still struggle with the most. Right? I do this exercise in some of the group therapy that I do where we break people up into dyads or groups of two, and they sit in front of each other, and I tell them that they can only share one at a time, and I'll give them a question or a reflection, something to talk about, and I'll ring the bell, and they'll be the only one talking, only one of the people, for 5 minutes. And the other person's instruction is just to listen. You don't have to nod your head. You don't have to interject. You don't have to validate. You don't have to say anything. You just listen. And it's really odd because the person will oftentimes report back how hard it was, that it was way more hard. I was giving them these challenging questions, talking about really personal parts of themselves, but it was harder for them to listen. Right? And then the person that was talking, and they would both take turns, always reports that it felt the best part of the exercise was being listened to. It wasn't even the insight that came from hearing themselves talk. It was just having someone there that didn't have to either encourage the conversation or invalidate the conversation. They just sat there and listened. And so, you know, one of the areas of practice is attunement. You know, as nothing brings us back into the body actually easier than what they call co-regulation, which means attuning to someone else and having a conversation, right? One of the best ways, I think we could all reflect, and you know, one of the best ways to feel better is to spend time one-on-one with someone and to talk to them, to share with them about what's going on with us. You know, and this is the first foundation of mindfulness. The Buddha encouraged to be practiced internally, externally, in both. That's in this 2,600-year-old instruction. The first foundation of mindfulness is to practice being aware of the body internally and being aware of the bodies externally and then the interaction between them. Tuning to one another, spending some time, slowing down, you know, seeing. And for a lot of us, for myself included, a lot of us, it's really hard to actually slow down and take the time to do that. We spend so much time outside of the body, caught up in, you know, the lists of things to do, caught up in, you know, in the in and out of our day, that we forget to, you know, settle in. And then as we attune, what happens is we practice that. And then, you know, how I experience that is just taking some time. I actually went through this intention after I left a retreat. You usually set an intention. My intention was to make eye contact with people more often. And it was incredibly uncomfortable for me. And it, not to be weird about it, right? Some people are like, you know, not like staring. You see some of those spiritual gurus that, like, they just, like, stare at, you know, like, staring into your soul. Or, it's kind of creepy. But it's just spending time attuning with people, you know, on the street, like looking up and kind of seeing if I can meet eyes with someone. We all know this experience, right? When you're walking down the road and you don't, you know, we don't really talk about it much, but that is a practice of attunement. Just kind of looking up and seeing if we can meet eyes and, you know, seeing if we can connect for a second and, you know, to witness the facial expression of someone. You know, ever notice that when you look at someone and if you smile or if you just kind of acknowledge someone, that their facial expression changes, that they relax into their body? I actually felt this today. I have a neighbor, someone that lives close to me, that is in a really famous band that I love. And they live like just a couple houses down, and I never meet eye contact with her. And today I was walking by and I was like, I'm just gonna do it. I'm gonna, like, I kind of look over, but today I was like, I just kind of like turned my body and like looked over, and she waved, And we both just kind of like relaxed. And I was like, oh, you know, it feels good to connect. You know, our insecurities often manifest in that form, right? Of, you know, but if we don't actually connect, then that feeling of anxiety or awkwardness, you know, we don't acclimate to that. It's like getting in a pool, right? When you get in a pool, if you just jump into the deep end, the first couple times you're really trying to do that intentionally, it feels really startling, you know, really awkward. And as we do that more and more, what happens is we actually then start to do this internal first foundation of body practice and is starting to, you know, observe the impact of an interaction. So then as we start moving into speech and we're like really holding space with someone, we could actually start to become more aware of how we're impacted by interaction. And the impact is what comes up for you as you listen. And are we attuning? Are we really checking into our own thoughts, you know, and emotions, physical sensations? A lot of our primary wounding stuff comes up around interaction. And so abandonment, I call it abandonment terror. Sometimes I don't actually go up to meet eye contact with someone just because if we misconnect, right? If we don't connect, you know, there's kind of that feeling of being excluded. Shame, Dave talked about this a couple weeks ago, this feeling that when walking into a room or, you know, coming into interaction that we feel like we don't have a place. And so we get to start to know, I always say it's not good news, right? But it's good information. We get to start to know, you know, how what this attachment wiring, how we attune, how we connect. It's really interesting to me. I sat a lot of silent retreats. And if you do it, you know, and I've assisted retreats before, so you get to sit in interviews with other people, and it's amazing to hear how much stuff comes up around the other people. And you don't talk to anyone on retreats. You don't interact with anyone. Right? So this is a huge, our relationships with one another, people experiencing threat and people experiencing, you know, feeling claustrophobic or closed in or feeling pressure, or feeling expectation. Starting to bring this into, you know, our awareness, the impact. And then into the communication itself, into words. You know, are we actually comprehending and clearly comprehending? Sampajanya is what the Buddha encouraged, clear comprehension. Are we clearly comprehending what we're hearing? Or are we hearing what we're projecting? Are we hearing what we heard last time? Right? You ever have an argument with someone and then you're talking to them a couple weeks later and you're still hearing the argument? And we filter speech often through our own perceptions, beliefs, and worldviews. And the deeper practice really becomes, can we listen through the content of what we're hearing, and can we actually listen to maybe what's, you know, the subtext, what the person's needing or what the person is really expressing. And as a, you know, therapist, I think this is a lot of what, why we pay the big bucks to go sit and pay someone, I do it, right, pay someone to listen to me. Because a lot of times the person I'm with has all this training and being able to more clearly comprehend beyond all the bullshit that I'm throwing out what I'm actually saying. Oh, it sounds like most of the therapy is just reflecting back what you hear. So I will say that in my experience, one of the best ways to interact with people is to reflect back to them what you're hearing. Best communication skill. So what I'm hearing you say is, or it sounds like, am I right? Right? People, I love that because it's And then if you're wrong, what you get is you get an opportunity to correct it. It's kind of communication 101. So that's, am I clearly comprehending what I'm hearing? You can actually start to ask that, or you know, find creative ways to, you know, interact in that way. So there are some helpful guidelines that the Buddha offered for active communication. And the first is these kind of four, which I actually really like this, is checking in as you communicate with other people too. Is this what I'm saying? So as you communicate, now we're talking about ourselves, is what I'm saying true, useful, timely, and kind? Right? And including all four of those. Because sometimes what I want to say is true, but it's not useful. Actually, a lot of the time, right? And we know these people that kind of pride themselves on being really direct, which can be refreshing, but also a lot of times it's not so useful. And there's a lot to that even, just honesty. Is what I'm saying honest? Is it true? And so, you know, part of the way to look at this is like, am I lying? And what I find is that the more that I investigate and become curious into why speech around truth is what I'm saying true, I don't really lie anymore. I lie through manipulation a lot. I lie through subtlety and omitting a lot. I encourage, right, and try to get things to be the way that I want them to, or get people to see things the way that I want them to. The rationalizing mind is very powerful. As a matter of fact, in neuroscience, they say that the human brain, the latest adaptation of our brain, its job is to rationalize the systems of the lower two brains, so our emotional brain. So what happens is rationalization finds itself into a lot of how we interact. Is what I'm saying true? Is what I'm saying useful? And one of these I really appreciate, is it timely? Is it the right time? And this being the middle path, it's never the perfect time. And sometimes I found myself using that to rationalize, well, it's not a good time, it's not a good time. You know, and having to almost be like, well, what's a good enough time to offer this information? And then is what I'm saying, is it kind? Can it be said in a way that, you know, is for the goodwill of the person that I'm speaking to? And kindness isn't the same as niceness. So sometimes what I have to say is really direct. And sometimes, especially if I feel like boundaries have been stepped on over and over again, I have to be really firm. You know, but I don't have to be harsh. I don't have to be hurtful. One of the things that the is a precept that we kind of train around in Buddhist practice oftentimes is not taking that which is not freely offered to us. So one way to say this is stealing, but it actually goes a little bit beyond that. It's not taking what's not freely offered. In some ways, in our communication, this is an area of practice. Now, how much time do we spend really, digging for information that's not being offered? You know, we do this a lot around gossip. I know I do. You kind of test the waters, talk a little bit of shit, throw a little bit of shit in there. You're almost trying to, you're really kind of provoking the other person to engage in unkind speech, right? You're kind of like, hey, come on, you want to do this? And then, also how much time, there are those people that I take up a lot of their time, right? And so just being aware of how much time do I spend with any one person. In my recovery practice, I learned a long time ago, they say, they have this phrase, the wider your base, the higher your point of freedom, which basically means the more people that you have, right, the more ease we feel. And so having more of a base and looking at, do I really take up one or two people's time with my stuff, and can I find more people and to have a broader base? Being mindful of frivolous chatter. So how much communication do we consume, and how much do we dole out? How much do we just kind of speak for the sake of speaking? And it could be fun. And my teacher, Dave, always says sometimes you just got to go to the mall and talk shit, right? Sometimes you just got to chat and chat, right? But also just being a little bit, with all of this communication and access to communication we have today, it's actually can be really overstimulating, you know, to constantly engage and to constantly be connected in the ways that we are today. You know, if you even look at, like, the evolutionary history of technology, we've only been communicating the extent we have for, like, 10 years. So we went from, like, I remember when I was a kid, my mom had one of those old-school car phones with the cord. And I remember thinking how stupid it was and telling her how ridiculous I thought it was that she would ever want to call someone between where she was and where she was going. Right? Because that was the kind of context, is like, well, you just, when you're at a place, you can make a call. Right? And usually it's work or home. But now, I mean, to be realistic about this, actually, you know, there's a somatic experience teacher, her name's Nancy Napier, I believe, and she talks about how all of this, the technological consumption we're doing, has created a parasympathetic nervous system response that is like this kind of subtle state of hysteria. She said that our media and all that we consume creates a hysterical nervous system response. And we see this in, you know, all of the emotionality and the sensationalism and all of this stuff, you know, that we see kind of kicked around. And so all of this, all that I'm saying, is not to be looked at as, oh, that's spiritual and that's unspiritual, that's good Buddhist, that's bad Buddhist, but it's all just a part of investigation for oneself, you know, looking into that. Refraining from gossip and divisive speech. I think that there's a, I don't know what it is about gossip. I don't know why, but it's just like, it can just feel so good sometimes, right? There's a meditation teacher that, I believe it was Joseph Goldstein, he may have been talking about someone else, but that made a commitment to not speak about someone that was not in the room for a whole year. They did that, right? Unless, I guess, they need to handle business or something like that. But out, just in their social interaction, they did not talk about someone that wasn't present. And just looking at, like, how much, and I just use that as something to be interested in. No, I'm not going to do that. I think I'd go crazy. Right, but even just looking at that is like, you know, from time to time, that's helped me out when I've thought about telling someone else's stuff, just being like, oh, they're not here. Would they, if they were here, would they want me to share this? Would I share this in the same way if they were here as when they're not? And then the importance of clarity and directness. You know, do we say what actually needs to be said? Or do we fall into this, what they call the Buddhist doormat syndrome, of just, you know, this passive? And that's part of our conditioning too, is avoidance of conflict. The Buddha was encouraging us to turn towards the causes and conditions that create suffering, to clearly see them with the mind, to be aware. And so that means having almost more conflict. Learning how to healthily express anger in the form of boundary and limit setting. Yeah. How can we mean what we say without being mean when we say it, right? That's another form of directness. Socrates says, I've noticed that anyone who is to form a right judgment must have three qualities: understanding, goodwill, and readiness to be perfectly frank. One of the things I really, I don't know if you've read any Socrates or classical philosophy, but one of the things that I like in Plato's writings about Socrates is he would stay in a conversation until it was done. They would write a whole book of one conversation that he would have until it was done. And he was so kind and understanding. And he would constantly say, let me see if I heard you correctly. You said this, you said this, you said that. Is that correct? And then he would say, please be as kind to stay in the conversation together until we finish. And he would encourage them and he'd say, I'm here with you. And they would be arguing the whole time. But it was the most, like, beautiful way to argue. And we need argument. I call it the art of argument. I think the Dharma and the path to liberation is one of arguing. But we have this kind of idea that arguing is yelling and it's not hearing and it's not understanding. But no, it's the exact opposite. With understanding, with kindness, and the readiness to be perfectly frank, we can get shit done. You know, and in this clarity and directness also, and I kind of said this already, the willingness to address important issues, not being dismissive. And part of communication is humility. How much suffering could I save myself in interactions with people if I was just willing to be wrong more often? And to say, oh, I'm sorry, I totally don't know what I'm talking about. I'll take up your, right? I'll listen to you and hear what you have to say. Communication and roles of leadership. I find this interesting. The Buddha included this in the discourses, you know, of how to teach the Dharma. He said, this is the person that's teaching the Dharma, I will speak the Dharma in a gradual way, refraining from confusing others with intellectualism. I will speak with the goal in mind. I will speak with kindness. I will not speak as a means of gain. I will speak not to harm anybody. Right, I really like this one of, I'll speak in a gradual way. We can, in this day and age, we can almost have this hyper-intellectualism. And I have myself been guilty of this, and I have noticed that we use language to disempower people. And we use language to, marginalize people out of conversation. If you can't teach the Dharma, if you can't teach in the Dharma, just meaning the truth of your experience, if you can't speak your truth in a way that the people, you know, around you are understanding, then I'm not so clear I know my truth. Right? And so just finding a way to speak and really listening, you know, and tuning in and finding a way to speak that's more inclusive. And being willing to just kind of try that on. You know, calling people into conversations instead of calling people out. That's another thing that we see, especially in kind of neoliberalism culture, is being the better liberal and being the better, more socially woke person. You know, what we do is we cause separation. Practicing authenticity and vulnerability. Sometimes we engage in this kind of connection standoff where it's like, once I see you be vulnerable and once I see you share parts of yourselves, then I'm willing to open up more. And we get in this almost kind of like, you know, and this has a lot to do with fear of being imperfect also. It's just being ourselves. Part of what we're trying to do is we're trying to include, and Vinny Ferrara, Against the Stream teacher, says that there are only two parts of yourself. There's what's loved and what's longing to be loved. And in mindfulness, we're including all of ourselves. It's radically authentic. the part of the mind that's just sitting there having a hard time during the meditation, that's included in the practice. That's not separate from the part of me that feels anxious or nervous talking about something, or the part of me that feels scared or frightened. All of these parts of ourselves are welcome. But finding, of course, safe people to interact with in those ways. Getting into the pool one foot at a time sometimes with wise friends. Starting to open up and really, push ourselves to be a little more open. We have different tendencies towards this. I'm an extrovert, so I overshare. Right? It's one of my tendencies. I will really tell you anything about myself. Pretty much anything. Right? I've gotten really used to that. But some people aren't as inclined towards that. And so where my edge may be to shut up a little more, and that I don't have to tell everyone everything. If you're more introverted, working towards having people to open up to more. And then the last one I want to share about is being willing to engage with people that have different views and opinions. I find this to be incredibly important. And I find this to be one of the reasons I believe that we experience the separateness that we do is because we're unwilling to engage with people that think and feel differently. Instead of inquiring and sitting down and saying, tell me about why you voted for that person. Why do you believe the way you do? Within safety, and there's a certain amount of privilege with this too, is like, sometimes people hold views and beliefs that are directly harmful to certain people, marginalized groups, vulnerable groups. And so being careful, but also opening up and seeing, if we can have some of these conversations with people. So these are some of my thoughts on communication.